E! News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. Work as a licensed professional counselor, mental health and wellness advocate, and make a difference. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing one of my all-time favorite interviews about the great William Shakespeare. In part two, you'll get some information from Joyce Gregg about the AAUW's spring used book sale and how they are proceeding with it, even within the constrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here's part one. I have always felt like I needed to know much more about William Shakespeare, such an important figure in history, and yet a surprisingly elusive figure about whom we actually don't know as much as you might think. And actually, if one does careful study, there's actually an amazing amount which, in fact, we can know about Shakespeare if we can better understand the world and the times in which he lived. That's essentially what James Shapiro has done. He's a professor at Columbia University in New York City and the author of several books about Shakespeare and the theater, and most recently, a marvelous new book called A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, 1599, in which he gives us a very clear sense of what was going on in Britain at this moment in its history. And not just within the arts and not just within the world of theater, but politically what was happening at this point in time, what people in the streets of London were talking about, worrying about. And it is a fascinating tapestry which has been woven in this book, which is published by HarperCollins. And I am indeed excited to speak with James Shapiro for the next few minutes about his book, again called A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare. James Shapiro, we welcome you to the morning show.
I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
Give our listeners a little bit of a sense of what I touched upon at the top of that introduction, namely that for someone who is so famous, how actually we know not as much about William Shakespeare and the specifics of his life and career as we might assume we do.
It's a funny question in certain ways, because we do know a lot about the years in which he was working in London, from sometime around 1590 until about 1614, roughly a quarter century. We know very little about his first 25 years, other than he was born in 1564 and baptized. He married at the age of 18 and had three children. That's really all that we know for sure about his earliest years. So when you write a cradle-to-grave biography of Shakespeare, almost inevitably you have to create a backstory about how Shakespeare got from Stratford to London and what motivated him, what crises, spiritual, familial, drove him there, and the rest. And that has made people skeptical about how much we can and do know about Shakespeare. Once he arrives in London and is an active and quite busy poet and playwright and figure playing both in public and at court, there are lots of records about him. And reflecting on this and having taught Shakespeare for almost all my adult life, I thought, why not go back and focus on a slice of life intensely, on a period of great creativity, a period where Shakespeare went from one creative level to the next, and tell that story, tell a year in the life of Shakespeare, rather than trying to do everything from speculate about what he was like as a child to what he was like after he retired from the stage. And it actually took me about 15 years of research. That's the downside of this quest, that it takes really a very long time to read everything written in a given year or written about a given year, and really think hard about what Shakespeare wrote in the course of this year in particular, 1599.
Well, and you're already touching on an important question, which is the fact that you did not arbitrarily choose the year 1599, but you chose it because, in your words in the introduction or the preface, by looking at this year, we can better answer the question of how Shakespeare became Shakespeare.
That's true. There are a number of things that were really appealing to me about 1599, not least of which was this was the year in which the Globe Theater was built, or actually not built, but rebuilt out of the frame of the theater Shakespeare's company used to perform at. It was called a theater, and they had lost their lease at the theater, and they still owned the structure itself. So at the very end of 1598, Shakespeare's company went to the site of their old playhouse armed with carpenters, and they took apart the building, packed it up, shipped it over the Thames, and it rose as the Globe Theater later that year. So this is a year in which Shakespeare became part owner in the theater, in which he performed in a company where he was a shareholder as well. So this year was both a wonderful year creatively for Shakespeare, and scholars know that. And haven't really spent enough time trying to figure out how Shakespeare really moved from writing a play like, say, Merry Wives of Windsor to Hamlet. What accounted for that really creative explosion in his work or spurt? And I wanted to deal with that. It's not to say that there aren't other great moments in Shakespeare's creative life, 1605, 1606, when he wrote Lear and Macbeth and started Antony and Cleopatra is a good time. Even a little bit earlier, 1595 or so, is also a very exciting time. But in a sense, 1599 is the Mount Everest for Shakespeare scholars who try to understand how you go about creating a play like Hamlet when there was nothing like it out there at the time.
Right. This is when he first begins to touch his true greatness. I mean, in a sense, creatively, Shakespeare turns a corner in this important year.
Yeah, and you can really feel it. It's not to diminish the accomplishment of plays like Henry IV or Richard II or Richard III or Romeo and Juliet, which are really wonderful plays. One of the things that got me going on this book was the movie Shakespeare in Love, which I really enjoyed, and which is a terrific movie, in part because it asked a great question, which was, how do you go from writing Two Gentlemen of Verona to a play as inspired as Romeo and Juliet? And the answer in the movie was, you fall in love with a cross-dressed Gwyneth Paltrow. And I didn't have an easy answer like that, but I wanted to figure out, how do you go from Romeo and Juliet to Hamlet? And that's a different kind of pursuit.
Let me ask you about the way in which many scholars have studied Shakespeare and discussed him. This is something else which is very interesting in your preface. You talk about how many have chosen to view Shakespeare as a poet who transcended his age. People have lifted him out of time and place in an effort, I suppose, canonize him, shine a light on his greatness. And you're saying that there are actually a couple of different reasons why scholars have been inclined to do that, and they seem very contradictory on the surface. You say it's because we know too much and we know too little about the times in which Shakespeare lived. Explain what you're talking about there.
Sure. One of the greatest and most influential critics in the English literary tradition, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, also a great poet, spoke of Shakespeare as if he were from another planet. And I think the desire to praise or almost overpraise Shakespeare has meant that we think of him as timeless and his works no longer rooted in the moment of their conception. And as a result, we have lost touch with what fueled Shakespeare's imagination. And that's very dangerous, in a sense, because that information exists. What information doesn't exist is who Shakespeare really loved, what he thought of his wife, whether he mourned for his son's death. Those are the questions we know too little about. Had antiquarians in the 17th century bothered to speak with Shakespeare's daughter, who survived almost a half century after her father, and spoken to her about what kind of man Shakespeare was, we would have had answers to some of those questions. But they still really wouldn't answer the question of what was going on during Shakespeare's creative life around him, not just in his personal life, but in London, in England, the political scene, the social changes, the religious crises of the age that shaped his imagination and that drove audiences to see his plays.
You mentioned the fact that that Shakespeare left behind neither letters nor diaries. And had he left that kind of legacy behind him, many of these kind of questions might have been answered, some of these mysteries solved.
That's certainly true. But your listeners should also know almost no one kept diaries in Shakespeare's day. Almost no one wrote personal essays in Shakespeare's day. It was a different culture, and I think we make a mistake in imagining that Shakespeare was like us. And I think a lot of biographers make a mistake of recreating Shakespeare in our own image. People 400 years ago were very different.
I'm so glad you said that, because this is one of the most intriguing moments in the introduction when you say, cradle-to-grave biographers of Shakespeare tend to assume that what makes people who they are now made people who they were then. And what you're suggesting is that human beings were shaped in different ways in Shakespeare's time, that they were powerfully affected by things that perhaps would not affect us today, or certainly not in the same way.
Which is why we call them pre-modern or early modern. Shakespeare's age was on the cusp of modernity, but it wasn't modern. Just take the life cycle for a good example of that. Children in their first year were wrapped in cotton, swaddled, and hung on a hook so that dogs would nibble at them or the kids would crawl into the fire. They were breastfed by strangers. They were, in their early years, shipped out to work in other people's households. People might have reached sexual maturity at 15, but they didn't marry until their mid-20s, and they died in their mid-40s on the average. So every aspect of life, including mandatory church services on Sunday, was different. And early modern people have a lot in common with us, but not everything in common with us. And even the fact that they didn't keep diaries, that they didn't keep journals, tells us something about how different their interior space was, their emotional lives might have been. We just don't know. And it's very dangerous to leap to the assumption that Shakespeare was like us or like we want him to be.
You say that the Shakespeare who emerges in these pages is less a Shakespeare in love than a Shakespeare at work. I guess that speaks to one of those points of frustration for you and others who want to know as much as they can about Shakespeare, that there is a real limit to just how much we can step inside his skin.
And not only that, there's a real limit to how much time Shakespeare had free. You know, we like to think of the artist scribbling with that quill in the attic somehow. Shakespeare spent his day, year in, year out, for much of his creative life, maybe a quarter century. He spent his mornings rehearsing that day's play, because it wasn't Cats now and forever in the Elizabethan theater. His company and every company changed the play they were staging every day. And since Shakespeare was an actor as well as the playwright in his company, he acted every day, which meant rehearsing that play in the morning, stopping for lunch, and performing that day's play in the afternoon. And that left him precious little time after dinner, probably by candlelight late into the night, to read as much as he read, and then to write as much as he wrote. So when I speak of Shakespeare at work, if Shakespeare had affairs and sexual encounters with men, women, or both during this time, it's a testament to his energy, because there was not a lot of time left over in his working day for that.
Well, especially at this point in time, as you say, when he was both actor and in a sense sort of a co-owner of this theater. I mean, so much of his life had to be absorbed by this unprecedented amount of responsibility.
Let alone lawsuits he was pursuing for his family and his father, pursuing a coat of arms. He was a businessman, although we tend not to speak of that in approving terms. And he was speculating in commodities. He was buying real estate. So he was a very complicated and very hardworking guy, and we tend not to think of artists in those ways. Mm.
Speaking of hardworking, you've already mentioned that this book was 15 years in the making. Give us just some sense, if you would, of where you had to go and through what sorts of boxes you had to sift to find the enormous wealth of information and insight which is part of this book.
Sure. I should say that the book almost can be traced back to my experience in high school and junior high of Shakespeare, where I hated Shakespeare, and I was completely turned off to Shakespeare by my teachers. So in a certain sense, my career is driven by what it felt like to feel stupid and confused reading Shakespeare. And I never even took a college course in Shakespeare. It was only after that that I became academically interested in Shakespeare. I'd see as many productions as I could, and I'd run over every summer after quitting some job as a messenger or salesman to London in my teens and early 20s to see as many plays at the RSC or the National Theater were putting on of Shakespeare's corpus. So this, in a sense, was rooted in that experience and in a desire to know what I didn't know about this culture. And that meant going to a handful of archives that really have vast wealth of really untapped materials. One is the Huntington Library in beautiful San Marino, California. Another is the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., right near the Capitol. And, of course, the archives in England, the British Library, the Bodleian in Oxford, the Cambridge Library, and the Warwickshire Archives and the Stratford Archives also. So it took a while, since I was teaching full-time during these years and I was writing other books as well, to dig up all the stuff that I was able to dig up and do it responsibly. And at a certain point, you have to say, I have to stop and finish writing the book.
The book we're talking about is A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, 1599, and we're speaking with its author, James Shapiro. You talk about how this was a moment just as the theater was being dismantled and the globe was about to be constructed from its timbers. You talk about Shakespeare being at a professional crossroads, that he had enjoyed a spurt of great creativity earlier in the decade, but a creative surge that had diminished. You talk about how Shakespeare was painfully aware that he had nearly exhausted the rich veins of romantic comedy and English history. It sounds like this was a moment in time when Shakespeare needed to find new things to write about.
You know, he didn't need to find. He chose to find. Shakespeare could have knocked out sequels for the next 20 years. He could have easily have done kind of Rocky II, Rocky III, Rocky IV, the Henry IV part 1 through 7, I suppose, and then do prequels and the like, or remake his extremely popular romantic comedies again and again and again, more Much Ado's, more Love's Labor's Won and Love's Labor's Lost. He was restless. He did not want to reproduce the same kind of work, however popular, however successful in the playhouse these plays were. And I think that's one measure of his greatness, his refusal to repeat himself. And he decided at this time to, in a sense, not only change what he was writing, but change what he was reading. Hmm. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is how he put down the big folio volume that had consumed him for the first decade of his career, Holinshed's Chronicles of England, Scotland, and Wales, and Ireland, and pick up instead a new book, a book that had been published by a friend of his from Stratford, who was also in London, named Richard Field. And that book was Plutarch's Lives of the Greeks and Romans. It was, let's say, more history, less history and more biography, and it would really lead him to write Julius Caesar in this year, and in future years, Antony, Cleopatra, and Coriolanus. But it really directed him towards focusing more on character and less on history, let's just say. But he also wanted to go back and rewrite plays that had been on the boards when he had first come to London, plays about Henry V, plays like Hamlet. And that's another thing that he had to do. In order to go forward, in other words, he had to go back a little bit and remake that past.
You talked, too, about how the opening of a new theater and Shakespeare becoming, in effect, one of its co-owners offered him a great opportunity for redirecting his art. You say the Globe offered Shakespeare a fresh start, the possibility of writing for a new set of playgoers with as yet unhardened expectations, unlike those who had been frequenting the theater and the curtain for so many years. I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, that's obviously a reality which is with us to this day, that writers find themselves thinking about the expectations of their audiences, and not just playwrights, but musicians of every ilk.
And you have to. And you can imagine the pressure on Shakespeare from his fellow shareholders, the actors who own the company with him, saying, we have this new theater. It's just a stone's throw away from our rivals, the Admiral's Men, playing at the Rose. You need to produce some great plays pretty quickly, or we're not going to carry our audience with us. And Shakespeare wrote a lot this year, and he wrote at a spectacular level, in part, I suspect, because of the pressure of writing both comedies and tragedies for this new theater that would enthrall audiences and make the Globe part of their lives.
I'd like to have you expound on an interesting observation you make, which is that although this is obviously a very rich era in terms of theater in London, I mean, that theater was such an important part of so many people's lives, but you say that the civic leaders of London actually had grave misgivings about the theater, and there was a very uneasy relationship between, for instance, the playwrights of the day and the government. Tell us more about that and what where that was coming from.
Sure. You know, it's very interesting and complicated, but not too complicated. City fathers, the rich burghers of London, didn't like theaters because they were a place where too many people gathered. They were often places where plague was spread or there was violence associated with the theaters. So there was a suspicion of big crowds assembling. So what the theater community did was planted the theaters just outside the bounds, the formal bounds of the city, the northern suburbs, and across the river in Southwark. And they also needed the protection of aristocratic patrons, which is why Shakespeare's company, though owned and run by a group of actors, was called the Chamberlain's Men. And then when King James came to power in 1603, they were called the King's Men after that. So that they had to have a bit of royal protection to protect them against the civil authorities. Plays were also censored. Shakespeare had to walk a careful line between what you could and could not get away with. In the late 1590s, there was a theater that opened up called the Swan, reportedly the most beautiful theater in London, and seditious plays, including one called The Isle of Dogs, which doesn't survive, was staged there. The government didn't like it and said there'll be no permanent company playing at the Swan from here on in, and that message got out. So Shakespeare had to write plays that engaged the political and social curiosity of his audiences while not stepping over that line. And for me, that's another sign of his genius, because Marlowe was assassinated, Kidd, Rack, Johnson, Chapman, and others imprisoned. Shakespeare never suffered that kind of direct government punishment or scrutiny.
Well, yes, because as you say, the punishment for overstepping the bounds of the acceptable was severe. And it's important for us to know that, because that helps us appreciate all the more the fact that Shakespeare did not choose what would have been the easier, safer path of just recycling what he had already written. He was willing to take some gambles.
And he knew that he had to, because if he didn't, he'd lose his audience, because other playwrights were more than willing to go out on that limb. And there's always this tension between writing popular stuff and pushing your audience a bit too far. And I think that Shakespeare pushed his audience, certainly in As You Like It, certainly in Hamlet, further than they were used to being pushed. And in As You Like It, it didn't quite succeed. In Hamlet, it succeeded brilliantly.
Let's talk about a couple other realities in England at this moment in time. One of them is that it is an interesting moment in time in terms of chivalry and the culture of chivalry, something which was beginning to fade from the scene. Tell our listeners more about that.
Sure. Chivalry was fraying. You know, there are a lot of books that celebrate the chivalric past, but the culture of knighthood was a threat to royalty, and Queen Elizabeth did her best not to knight many of her followers and keep that number small and in control. She knew well enough from the example of English history that the greatest threat to her throne came not from outside of her kingdom, but from those trying to usurp her throne from within. One of the great events of this year, really, that cast its shadow over all of 1599 was wrapped up with this question of chivalry and almost accounts for the death of chivalry or the severe decline of it. And that has to do with a war in Ireland. England had been settling in Ireland, or the English had been settling in Ireland for centuries, but the pace of really the colonization of Ireland had picked up in Elizabeth's reign. And the Irish finally were successful in attacking the English army and English communities that had appropriated Irish land. And in 1599, Queen Elizabeth knew that in order to protect her subjects living in Ireland, she had to send an army into Ireland. And when I began this book 15 years ago, I had no idea that I'd be writing a book about an attempt to send an army that was ill-equipped and expensive to fight an insurgency that proved far more sophisticated and adept in attacking those invading what they believed was their country. But that's really what happened in this year. And it was a disastrous military campaign. Shakespeare alludes to it explicitly in Henry V when he talks about their hope, the Londoners' hope, his audience's hope, that the Earl of Essex, the general of our gracious Empress, Queen Elizabeth, will come home from Ireland with rebellion broached on his sword. In fact, Essex, who did very little against the Irish and knighted as many followers as he could, harbored hopes of coming back from Ireland, leading an army to the court and in an attempt to shake up the political order. He was talked out of that by his friends. 2 years later, he actually did mount a coup, which was disastrous, as equally disastrous as his military campaign. But the breakdown of this campaign in Ireland really colors everything going on in this year, up to and including Hamlet.
You mentioned, by the way, that Queen Elizabeth had a lot to do with the troubles with this Irish campaign. You called her Irish policies characterized by incoherence and neglect.
Queen Elizabeth was brilliant politically, but she was also a skinflint and did not want to spend money. She didn't have a standing army. And when recruits were dragged off the street, because that's the way you get 16,000 men, every man from 16 to 60 could be conscripted unless he had a kind of political connection, as, say, Shakespeare and his company who played at court did. But these wars were not popular. Queen Elizabeth was not willing to spend enough to really deal with the problems. She wanted problems to go away. And she was most formidable in personal encounters. She was smarter than everybody around her. She had the skills of a real political survivor, but she was not good at managing the wars, and it bled the country slowly.
You talked, too, about how hanging over so much of all of this was kind of the question of what next for Queen Elizabeth, how much longer she was going to reign, that kind of thing. What are we talking about in terms of the year 1599? How long had she been queen?
She had been queen since 1558, 6 years before Shakespeare was born. It's the only queen most everybody in the country had known. And yet, she was the Virgin Queen. She had no designated heir to the throne. You were not allowed to write about who would succeed her. You were not allowed to talk about it. This was a punishable offense. And everybody waited every day as rumors spread, oh, the queen is sick, the queen is dying, the queen is... nobody knew. And there was tremendous anxiety. And it's no surprise that so many of Shakespeare's plays and those of his contemporaries are plays about succession. A play like Hamlet, it's about how a foreign ruler comes in at the end to take over the country. Play after play dealt with this because this was a barely suppressed anxiety in the culture. They didn't know if a Catholic prince would come into the country or a Protestant one. It affected every aspect of their lives. As it turned out, King James VI of Scotland would come in and rule over England from 1603 on. But nobody knew that for a fact. And in fact, there were rumors in 1599 that an impatient King James was ready to join forces with the Spanish to invade England. So history looks a lot different in retrospect. What I try to create in this book is the day-to-day experience of the fears, the hopes, the rumors, rather than what history books tell us what actually happened. A good example of that is in the summer of 1599, in July, just when the Globe Theater was finished, when they're finishing the thatching, finishing the painting of the stage and all, a rumor of a Spanish armada once again invading England took over the country. And the Queen called for 30,000 troops to come down to protect London, 3,000 to stand around her personally and protect her person, and the country was in a panic. Now, it turned out, as contemporaries called it, to be an invisible armada rather than the invincible armada of 1588. But this is the kind of stuff that flavored the year and shaped the expectations of an audience. The massive preparations that summer, night and day, to fend off the Spanish threat are found in the opening scenes of Hamlet, where you hear a character come on stage and say, you know, why is everybody preparing madly against this foreign threat? It had to send a shiver of recognition through everyone in the theater that day when Hamlet was staged.
Something else going on at this moment in time is lodged a little more in the religious realm. You say Shakespeare was born into an England poised between worlds. You say while the Elizabethans didn't suffer the bloody religious wars that racked much of the continent, its reformations meant, among other things, a stripping away of altars, paintings, ceremonies, vestments, sacramental rituals, and beloved holidays. And you say then, for reformers seeking to purify a church they saw encrusted with idolatry, this made good sense. But in practice, it also left a tear in the fabric of daily life. If one is interested in understanding the daily life of people in this time, this is one of the things we need to notice.
It's very important. And when a lot of critics or scholars talk about Catholicism or Protestantism in Shakespeare's day, it's as if they're talking about Red Sox fans and Yankee fans, a clean-cut distinction or a clear-cut distinction. Between the 1530s and the 1590s, or even late 1550s, England went from Catholic to Protestant to even more Protestant to Catholic and back to Protestant again. So everything was in turmoil. Everybody, including Elizabeth, and no doubt Shakespeare, longed for certain parts of old Catholic ritual that Protestantism did not embrace, and at the same time were connected to the new state religion, which put more emphasis on the word than on other symbolic practices that Catholicism offered, including the holiday season. So this was a culture in turmoil and transformation, and one of the things that theater did was it filled that vacuum left by the loss of a lot of Catholic ritual that offered a different kind of spectacle and ritual and splendor, but no less indebted to the word. So it's something that scholars right now are turning their attention to after a decade or two of just looking at a narrow set of concerns of race and class and gender, which are important, but religion is the most important thing shaping Shakespeare's culture, and the politics as well as the spiritual lives of Elizabethans.
I want to finish by asking you just a question or two about Hamlet, which of course is really in many respects the artistic culmination of this year. One of the things you do in your book is you help us understand how the play Hamlet came into being, and you start one chapter with this incredible statement. In terms of plot, Hamlet is Shakespeare's least original play. And of course, you go on to explain what you're saying there, that Shakespeare was drawing upon other sources quite heavily, but brought his genius to bear and turned it into something truly incredible.
You know, what Shakespeare's company did with their old theater, strip it apart and make something new out of the structure itself, the beams, is exactly what he did to Hamlet. He took an old play that was already old, also called Hamlet, in the 1580s, and he remade it. He transformed it utterly while keeping the plot, keeping the characters. The soliloquies are all Shakespeare's, what he does, the language is Shakespeare's, but his audience would have been able to follow this brilliant play in part because they knew the outline of that story, which is not. Shakespeare was never interested in creating stories. He was interested in transforming them and making them fresh and inimitable.
One of the ways he did that, of course, is in the words he chose. And you talk about how, just looking at the plain old numbers, it's incredible what Shakespeare did with words in Hamlet, with new words, which helped make this sound like a play that people had never heard the likes of before.
You know, we kid around today about the playgoer who goes to see Hamlet at the behest of friends and comes back and says, I liked it a lot, but it was full of cliches. These weren't cliches. Shakespeare's inventing phrases and words that have stuck in our imagination. Hamlet has fistfuls of them. The creative inspiration that must have been behind that must have been incredible. And the closest I get to really peering over Shakespeare's shoulders, the closest I got to Shakespeare and the whole experience of writing this book was watching him take his first draft of Hamlet and revise that draft, cutting famous soliloquy, changing characterization. You begin to really understand how Shakespeare wrote and rewrote, because it wasn't a first draft. Shakespeare was a great reviser, and he understood what he had to cut, including a great soliloquy, to save his play.
I want to also just quickly ask you about another device which Shakespeare uses so much in Hamlet, and this is this device of pairing two things together.
Hendiades.
Yes. And this idea of one by means of two, linking two nouns with the simple word and. You talk about how this is used so much in Hamlet, and that it speaks to something in the collective soul of England at this time, a longing to try to put things together and understand the world in which they were living.
You know, I chose Hendiades almost arbitrarily as one rhetorical trope because Shakespeare's linguistic, you know, prowess is unbelievable, and you can spend books just on the language of Hamlet. And here I was lucky to draw on the work of other scholars who had teased out and listed all of these. You know, Hendiades sounds like a fancy word, but we know this word from how it appears in our own culture. Phrases like law and order, house and home, sound and fury. Shakespeare, it's actually hard to use those phrases in poetry and in everyday speech or invent them. And Shakespeare invents dozens of them in Hamlet. And these words exist, sound and fury, law and order, as terms that modify another term but are really destabilized by their proximity to each other. And it creates that kind of unnerving feeling we get when we see or read a play like Hamlet. It's too hard to explain in a sentence or two, but what I'm trying to get at is Shakespeare is reaching another level of verbal complexity that no one really has reached before or would ever reach again. And these are the kind of things that I try to pinpoint as best I can to give readers a sense of not just how overwhelming Shakespeare's writing is, but how you can see its greatness in very particular ways.
Hmm. You talk about how writing for Shakespeare was a battering experience, and I'm sure for you as well, to some extent, this had to be that kind of experience, exhaustive research over the course of many years, but the result is an absolutely marvelous book, again called A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, 1599, published by HarperCollins, the author James Shapiro. James Shapiro, I congratulate you.
Thank you.
Something superb, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today.
I'm very grateful for our conversation. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
I know that there are a lot of book lovers who listen to the morning show. I am a book lover myself, and on more than one occasion, I have availed myself of the book sale that is conducted by AAUW. And we're going to be talking about their spring book sale, which is coming up beginning this Monday, the 15th of March, and going to be finding out a little bit about the logistical challenges of launching an event like this during COVID-19. And, of course, we're all well acquainted with the restrictions and complications that COVID-19 has posed to all kinds of things that we used to do without any care or concern whatsoever. And now to do things like the book sale means thinking about a lot of matters related to COVID and keeping people safe. I'm really pleased to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Joyce Gregg, who is chair of the book sale committee for AAUW. And we're going to be finding out from her how their book sale is going to go ahead despite the restrictions of COVID-19. Joyce Gregg, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to hear your voice again. It's been a while. I wonder if you could say a word about AAUW and its essential central mission. Who is AAUW?
Of course. AAUW is the American Association of University Women, and it's a national organization with a branch in Racine who promotes equity and education for women, lifelong learning. And so it is a large branch. We have almost 200 members in Racine and very active in promoting education and equity for women.
Very good. And I know that one of your biggest sales or events of the year is your book sale, which I have enjoyed visiting and participating in on more than one occasion. Your book sales in recent months, I assume, have been very much impacted by COVID-19. Tell us the first time COVID-19 played a role in one of your book sales. Would that have been last spring, approximately a year ago?
Correct, last May. And, of course, it was fairly new then, and so we did not have a sale in May. And then in November, we decided, well, we could probably do it with a limited number of people. And so we did it in October and November and part of December and had five people each hour, and they made appointments. And so that worked very well, and people were really happy, one, to be able to get to the book sale, and they kind of liked being only one of five people in the store. As you know, the store is large. It's almost as large as CVS because it's below CVS, so at least half as large as CVS. And so it afforded a lot of space for each of them.
Right. So so those who come and visit the book sale do not need to feel like they're kind of shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow with others.
Correct.
Who are looking at books. And that's, of course, sometimes the way it is. And that's also, in some respects, sort of part of the fun of it. But during this pandemic, we need to be really mindful of that sort of thing. We should clarify for people who maybe don't know what we're talking about. When you say that you're in the basement of CVS, you're referring to the CVS pharmacy on, is it Taylor or Osborne? I forget.
Washington Avenue and West Boulevard.
And West Boulevard.
And right next to the old Piggly Wiggly behind Tenuta's or what was Durango's.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so you have, in a sense, commandeered, although with permission, the basement of that CVS building. And
mm-hmm. Technically, it's a garden level. It you can access it from the outside or the inside.
And describe for somebody who has never been there before what they will see when they walk in the door of the AAUW book sale.
Well, for one thing, you'll see lots of books. We haven't ever counted, but I'm sure there are over 50,000. And we have everything. All of our books are donated by the community. And so we have rare books and unusual books. And we have fiction and nonfiction, lots of children's books, religion, sci-fi, how-to books, cookbooks, gardening, history, We have a separate room for fine arts and for health and self-help. And so anything that you can imagine, we probably have.
Hmm.
And it's all the thing that most people really like about our sale is it's well organized. And so the nonfiction is by category, and the fiction is all alphabetical by author. So if you're looking for your favorite author, they will all be together. You won't have to look through tables full to find your author.
Right. And, you know, this is in stark contrast to a lot of venues in which someone looks through used books, including a lot of used bookstores are not as well organized as your book sale. And there are some book sales, I'm thinking, for instance, of certain book sales I've been to with public libraries where it's just a big, huge pile of books. And and it takes hours and hours and hours to really figure out what's there and find anything you might be looking for. And this is really set up, organized, and even to some extent almost looks like a bookstore.
It does. It's we have lots of bookshelves and tables and a very dedicated committee that does a great job of sorting. And so if you're looking for something, there's a good chance that if you ask one of our volunteers for a book, we might be able to find it because we become very familiar with our area of sorting. So,
So it is the members of your committee who are responsible then for this monumental task of keeping all of this as well organized as it is.
Correct. And volunteers from the organization, but mostly our very active committee. And we, you know, as I said, get books from the community. They can donate any time of the year. So we rent the space year-round. So it really is a year-round project. And when we get bored at home, we go down and sort some more books.
Very good. So the job is never done, and happily so for those of you who really enjoy this. So explain to our listeners how they can visit the AAUW Spring Book Sale starting on Monday, March 15th.
Sure. We're going to be open Monday and Saturday mornings from 9:30 to 12:30 and Wednesdays from 9:30 to 3:30. And so they can call me. My number is 632-6341. And I will set up an appointment for a one-hour visit. If they need more time, they can request 2 hours, but 1 hour is usually good for most people. And then I schedule 10 people at a time, and they can come down and shop during that hour.
Very good. And the money that is raised from the AAUW book sale, how is it used?
Well, the money is split 50-50. Half of it we send to the national organization to sponsor their work in promoting education and equity for women. And the other half goes to our local scholarship program. We offer scholarships each year for a junior or senior in college. And so those applications have just finished, but it's split 50-50 between the local and the national organization.
Very, very good. The phone number, again, people should call if you want to make an appointment to visit the extraordinary AAUW book sale is 632-6341. And how long does the spring book sale last?
Until May 8th, so it's about 8 weeks.
Very good. Well, as someone who has visited it numerous times and come away with great treasures, I highly recommend that people seek this out. And Joyce Gregg, thank you for being part of the morning show, and thank you for all of your hard work on behalf of AAUW and its wonderful book sale.
Okay, thank you. We look forward to seeing everybody.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to The Morning Show. And with her, Joe Pfeiffer, who has been working on the Meacham Road restoration project in Mount Pleasant. We'll be hearing all about it. And on Wednesday, a look at volcanoes through the eyes of Jess Phoenix. Her book is called Ms. Adventures. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. Work as a licensed professional counselor or mental health and wellness advocate. Details are available at uwp.edu. And remember, you can subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with